Silas Hammer heard it first on a wintry night in February. He and Dick Borrow had walked from a dinner given by Bernard Selden, the nerve specialist. Borrow had been unusually silent, and Silas Hammer asked him with some curiosity what he was thinking about. Borrow's answer was unexpected. "I was thinking that of all these men tonight, only two amongst them could lay claim to happiness, and that these two, strangely enough, were you and I." The word "strangely" was apposite, for no two men could be more dissimilar than Richard Borrow, the hard-working East End parson, and Silas Hammer, the sleek, complacent man whose millions were a matter of household knowledge. "It's odd, you know," mused Borrow. "I believe you're the only contented millionaire I've ever met."
HPPodcraft.com.
Borrow seems to be referencing the book of the Notorious B.I.G., saying that if one has more money, one has more problems.
It's true.
I'll quote directly. Okay. "I don't know what they want from me. It's like the more money we come across, the more problems we see."
Nailed it.
"It's a thought humanity has explored since time immemorial, and we are exploring this idea with the author Agatha Christie and her very weird tale, The Call of Wings." I'm Chris Lackey.
And I'm Dick Borrow. Did Agatha Christie write this story for middle school students? Because this would have been a huge hit with my sixth graders when I was teaching. And I would have leaned into it, too. I would have passed out a quiz covering the story and asked, what can we guess about the character of Dick Borrow from his name? Because I am Chad Pfeiffer, a gift to principals all over the country, because they really would have liked me but still had to fire me. Luckily, I'm working in the much more lax world of the internet. At hppodcraft.com, strange studies of strange stories. You know, when it's cloudy, you can't see the stars, but you should never be sad because you can always hear them here. Ladies and gentlemen, our reader today is none other than Agatha Christie fan Andrew Lehman. He's the best at what he does, and what he does is very pretty. You can get oodles of it at the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society. Props, movies, merchandise, and audio. Right now, as a matter of fact, they are taking pre-orders for the Dark Adventure Radio Theater production of The Curse of Yig, which is a favorite story of mine.
Get in on that. Make sure you get pre-order that stuff, because they're hot. The Dark Adventure Radio Theater stuff is hot.
And the people that make them, even hotter. We are continuing with our spooky month of mystery authors writing weird fiction, and this is a suggestion from Stuart Huntsman, who suggested The Hound of Death as well, and who wrote that this story invokes a character we have seen before a few times on this show, so... why don't we just dig in?
Our story begins with two men walking home from a dinner party held by Bernard Selden, a nerve specialist, as in a psychologist, not like a neurosurgeon.
I thought somebody would get a pinched nerve in their back and he'd use it to summon Cthulhu. Like the story would go there.
Yeah. It's a cold winter night in February, and the two men are Silas Hammer, a millionaire, and Dick Borrow, a parson.
I believe Borrow is meant to indicate some low status. He's an East Ender. Silas Hammer, I thought, was interesting. I think there's something going on with the name there as well. Silas means man of the forest. It's a derivative of Sylvanus, who was the Roman god of forests. Often associated with nymphs and pans and whatnot. And Hammer is, of course, a reference to the tool, which is something that fastens things in place.
So on their walk, both agree that they were the only happy people at the party.
Yeah, Borrow brings that up.
He wonders how Silas's life goes against the book of the Notorious B.I.G. And Silas explains he doesn't want power. He just wants comfort. He was poor as a child and he worked his way up from being a newspaper boy. So he knows insecurity, which is something that he doesn't have now. He's very secure. He has great food and comfort, and that's all he ever really wanted. He's a materialist through and through. Silas doesn't understand how Dick is fine with dealing with the poor and their troubles and all the sadness and misery that he must see. How can he be happy? And Dick says, well, it's not easy to understand unless you have visions. And I think what he means by visions is faith. And Silas says that he doesn't believe in anything that he can't see, feel, or hear.
And ultimately, this is about some worldview stuff. He says, I need to be able to see something or feel it in order to believe it. And also, he's a materialist in terms of I want to acquire material possessions for comfort. Maybe not too much, but I just want to have my things. And obviously, when you start somebody in that place, where can you go if he's already content in that respect? And I think it's spiritual stuff. So I'm like, okay, we're definitely going to be talking about this. I thought it was interesting that he said a predominant vision, capital V, upholds me. It's not easy to understand unless you believe in visions. Both times with the capital V. I thought it was cool because, like you say, I think it's a reference to faith, but it could also be a faith in some sort of vision. Like, I have a vision of a society where people are you know, where there's equity and plenty. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a orthodox religion. When they split up, Dick says, well, goodbye, the earth now swallows me up. Meaning they've reached the tube station and he's got to go underground to grab the train. The tube immediately represents the unwashed masses. The earth is going to swallow him up. I think about the time machine, how the Morlocks live down there.
Sure. So Silas and Dick, they part ways and Silas is on his own enjoying the comfort of his warm coat. He stops and he sees a bus is coming and he could rush across the street, but he's like, why rush? That's unbecoming of me. I could just wait. I'm in no big hurry. As he waits, this poor drunken man stumbles past him and into the street, and that guy's hit by a bus. A crowd gathers and the driver stops. A rough looking man is standing next to Silas and he says, don't you blime yourself, governor. You couldn't have done nothing. It was done for anyways. Silas is shocked by this because it never occurred to him that he could have done anything about this. Hmm. This sets him off a bit. He starts thinking about death and his own mortality and that maybe it could have been him that was hit by the bus. And he becomes deeply afraid of death and realizing, you know, I'm not going to escape it. It's going to get me one day.
I can certainly relate to that. Sudden onset of panic. I think anybody who encounters something that reminds them of their mortality can relate.
Yeah.
Last summer, we were in a car wreck, and that's how I spent the rest of my day, was thinking about that stuff.
Ugh. I honestly am not too worried about my own death, but I'm worried about my family and how they would deal with it, especially my kids. Because obviously, when you die, you don't know you're dead.
The joke, I'm not afraid of dying, I just don't want to be there when it happens, is very, it is a true thing though, because I don't fear death as in the state of it, because you're not there anymore, you know, the rare person knows when that's going to happen. So,
oh yeah,
it's the circumstances are obviously what is the cause of dread.
Silas walks off the main street and down a smaller, quiet street closer to his home when he hears some strange music. And there's a legless man sitting on the ground next to a pair of crutches, and he's playing a flute-like instrument.
This is very similar to Eddie Murphy in the beginning of Trading Places. He was faking not having legs. But that movie was kind of a spiritual cousin to this story, I thought. It's a class analysis. You're going to take a rich person and a poor person and see how they can change and how they can affect each other. I don't know if Trading Places is still a popular movie. I think younger audiences might like it because there's some really good Wall Street comeuppance in that movie. And it's still funny. And sorry. I just got a text from Dan Aykroyd that says, don't tell them about that. I'm wearing blackface in that movie. Oh. Yeah.
Oh, no.
It's a good one, but yeah, maybe don't rewatch it.
Yeah.
Let's look instead at this guy Silas comes across. It says he was sitting against a wall, a man playing the flute. One of the enormous tribe of street musicians, of course, but why had he chosen such a peculiar spot? And it was not a flute he was playing, but a strange instrument whose notes were much higher and clearer than those of a flute.
The man played on. He took no notice of Hammer's approach. His head was flung far back on his shoulders, as though uplifted in the joy of his own music, and the notes poured out clearly and joyously, rising higher and higher. It was a strange tune. Strictly speaking, it was not a tune at all, but a single phrase, not unlike the slow turn given out by the violins of Rienzi, repeated again and again, passing from key to key, from harmony to harmony, but always rising and attaining each time to a greater and more boundless freedom. It was unlike anything Hammer had ever heard. There was something strange about it, something inspiring and uplifting. He caught frantically with both hands to a projection in the wall beside him. He was conscious of one thing only, that he must keep down. At all costs, he must keep down.
Suddenly, the music stops and he finds himself clutching the stone buttress. He really thought he was actually going to float off the ground. And he laughs at this idea. And as he's laughing, the man gets on his crutches and he walks away.
It's a really interesting scene. And this repetitive music, I know they make some references to Rienzi, which we could talk about a bit later, but the Rienzi reference might have been more commonplace in 1933 when this came out. By the way, the story was released in that year as part of The Hound of Death and Other Stories. So same volume that as collection. The last one we read. Yeah. Which actually weirdly wasn't published by her regular publishers, and it wasn't published in the US at all. And
oh, I didn't know that.
The thing I read said it wasn't even available in shops. I think it was something you had to order. Most of the stories, there's no detective stuff. Most of them are about fate and the supernatural. But as I was saying, the description of this music I felt was really in line with minimalism or minimal music, which is actually really in vogue right now with film scoring, I'm noticing. but it has its roots in the 1960s New York art scene. Philip Glass is probably the most famous minimalist musician. You'll notice that in a lot of his scoring, he'll stack simple repeating phrases on each other, and then they come together in interesting ways to create something more complex.
Right.
This is a left turn from the story for a second, but it's related. Okay. You know, this is a philosophy that's always been appealing to me as an artist, because I think you do better work when you limit the universe of tools and resources that you have.
Yeah.
And that's really the whole idea behind minimalism, is taking that kind of to an extreme. Tom Johnson was one of the few composers to self-identify as a minimalist, and he wrote in the Village Voice what he thought this was about. The idea of minimalism is much larger than many people realize. It includes, by definition, any music that works with limited or minimal materials. Pieces that use only a few notes, pieces that use only a few words of text, or pieces written for very limited instruments, such as antique cymbals, bicycle wheels, or whiskey glasses. It includes pieces that sustain one basic electronic rumble for a long time. It includes pieces that move in endless circles. It includes pieces that permit all possible pitches as long as they fall between C and D. It includes pieces that slow the tempo down to two or three notes per minute. As you may suspect, some of this music is absolutely terrible and unlistenable. And, you know, I'm sensitive to repetition even in pop music. It's a failing. If something is too long and repeats the part, I will turn it off. But then sometimes you hear this minimalist music and it really rises. It does what it's supposed to be doing. As I said, all this is kind of a left turn, but I think it's in line with Christie's theme here. It's about resources. That's what minimalism is about. Mm. You would think that the person with the most resources would be making the best art and would be making the most rich art. The fact is that the person with the fewer resources is often creating a more harmonious. I mean, right? This is one character has so much wealth, but it's the one with the fewer resources that is living a more harmonious life. And the rich man's life here, when confronted with the ultimate obstacle of death, is suddenly dissonant. He's forced to admit to himself that he was afraid, horribly afraid of death. Death that came with dreadful swiftness and remorseless certainty to rich and poor alike. Yeah. And I think in this pandemic, that notion is once again in front of mind. The disease doesn't care what your background is or who you are or how powerful you are or anything.
I'm really keen on this making a whole musical piece out of whiskey glasses.
The idea behind minimal music, I think, appeals because when I first started doing things creatively, I didn't have any money to buy equipment or anything like that. You had to work with whatever you could find or do, whether it was tape recorders or hip hop comes out of poverty. Yeah. Nobody's got drum machines and synthesizers, especially when those things are so expensive. So let's take those musical parts out of a disco song and loop them and then do something with that. It's taking very little and still making a rich piece of art out of it, and I think that this story is going right for that idea.
So Silas goes on to his house, and then he has an impulse to talk to this guy, and he hurries back after the legless man. When Silas reaches him, they're standing under a light, and the man turns, and Silas sees that he's beautiful. The man possessed the most singularly beautiful head he had ever seen. He might have been any age, assuredly he was not a boy, yet youth was the most predominant characteristic. Youth and vigor in passionate intensity.
Uh-oh, it's Dorian Gray.
Oh no!
Get out of there. He doesn't have legs because his legs weren't in the painting. So they rotted away and fell off they aged. That would happen, right?
That would be such a rad story. It's like Dorian's legs are old. So he's always wearing trousers to hide his legs and never has shorts on. And everybody's swimming. That could be a scene in the book. And
I caught a glimpse of his shin and it was elderly.
He asks the man about the song that he was playing, and the man says it's very old. And the man talks strangely. So Silas wants to know where he's from, but he cryptically says that he's from over the sea. Silas asks about the way that this man lost his legs, and the man says, it's okay. They were evil.
You know, this story isn't particularly scary, except right there.
Yeah.
They were evil. You cut off your legs or something? You know, whoa. It's not what you expect somebody that has a missing limb to say.
That brings up a lot of questions. But Silas just gives the guy a shilling and walks away. He's perplexed by what he said. He thinks maybe he meant, I had a disease in my legs and the disease was evil. So when I lost my legs, it was actually an okay thing.
Yeah, they were infected.
But he still thinks that's not what that guy meant.
Sounded like he was warning him to look out for disembodied legs.
So that night in bed, he's still bothered by what happened. He can hear the clock strike one, and it's all quiet. But then in the distance, he hears the music again.
Clearer and clearer, higher and higher, each wave rising above the last and catching him up with it. This time he did not struggle. He let himself go, up, up, The waves of sound were carrying him higher and higher, triumphant and free. They swept on, higher and higher. They had passed the limits of human sound now, but they still continued, rising, ever rising. Would they reach the final goal, the full perfection of height? Rising. Something was pulling him downwards, something big and heavy and insistent. It pulled remorselessly, pulled him back and down, down.
So he comes out of this experience and he finds himself in bed, his arms stretched out. He's breathing heavily. Everything is oppressive to him, his bedclothes, even his body.
You know, a lot of people are getting these weighted blankets to help calm anxiety. Or have you heard of that?
Oh, no.
I heard that, I thought, God, that would make me feel like this guy feels. I having a weight on top of me? I don't know if I like
Well, there's that.
That,
you know how we all say there's five senses, but there's actually more senses than that. Your sense of direction, like up and down, it's proprioceptor. I can't remember what it's called, but it's the pressure on your body. If somebody squeezes you, that feeling that you get, it's one of the senses. They find that people, or some animals actually, that have anxiety or freaking out, if they get squeezed, cows specifically, cows being squeezed makes them feel better.
I didn't know about cows. I mean, I know they have like thunder shirts for dogs.
Also swaddling babies.
Yeah.
You know, that feeling of being wrapped up and snug is, I guess, supposed to connect you to how it felt when you were in the womb, because you were all crammed in there and it made you feel secure. So that's why babies get calm when they're swaddled. So, but I can see why the weighted blanket might have that effect on people, or give them a feeling of security.
Yeah, but a 200-pound blanket, that's what this guy was trying to sell me. Makes no sense. Why? How would that be something you'd want to get rid of?
Was it human-shaped? So we jump ahead. Silas is at dinner with Bernard Seldon, the nerve specialist, and he explains he thinks that he's losing his mind. Seldon, he's very sympathetic and not judgy, and he actually tries to help Silas out. Silas tells him about the experience with the legless man and the dream or whatever it was.
What if it was like a human chair kind of scenario, you know, like a guy tried to squeeze himself into a blanket and then sold it to somebody and that was his whole scam? Like, you could clearly see the guy in the blanket. All right. Well, so this sensation or dream has gone on ever since that first experience. Not every night, just now and then, he says. The music, the feeling of being uplifted, the soaring flight, and then the terrible drag, the pull back to earth, and afterwards the pain, the actual physical pain of the awakening.
He loves this experience. It's not horrifying.
He's even like cleared out a space in the house, sort of a balcony that or deck that he's put up on top, where there's no furniture open to the sky, no carpets, nothing to make him feel like he's pulled down.
Seldon tells him to go out into open country and it might stop the dreams. But Silas, he's like, I don't want them to stop. I can't do without them. So Seldon tells him to talk to the legless man, since he was the one that kind of started this whole thing. Maybe he's going to be able to help him out. Give him some sort of insight into what's going on. But Silas says he's actually afraid of seeing this guy again. Seldon asks about the music, and he says it sounds a bit like the overture from Rienzi, and that's a Wagner piece. Silas goes on to explain that each of these flights he takes, he gets to a higher point. These waves kind of push him higher and higher, but it's not a place as much as it is a state of mind or a being. There were sensations of light, then of sound, then of color, all very vague and unformulated. It was more the knowledge of things than seeing or hearing them. First, it was light, a light that grew stronger and clearer, then sand, great stretches of reddish sand, and here and there, straight long lines of water like canals. And Silas explains that he sees wings, wings of a beautiful color, and Seldon asks, what color? And he says, I don't know. I couldn't see, not yet, but the color of them, wing color. We haven't got it here. It's a wonderful color. And Seldon's like, well, explain it. He goes, how can I tell you? Explain the color of blue to a blind person. It's the color you've never seen. Wing color.
That's a very Lovecraftian idea. It's a color that we've never seen before.
That would be a good way to describe another color, would be some sort of abstract concept. You go, it's hope.
Yeah.
It's hope color. Like, what's that? It's the only way I could describe it. It's hope. That's the way that the color is. At this point in his vision or dream or whatever it is, he has no physical presence. But then he's pulled back to earth, to reality, and it's painful. He says, these things, comfort, luxury, pleasure, seem to pull opposite ways of the wings. It's a perpetual struggle between them, and I can't see how it's going to end. Selden tells him, well, just wait and see. That's all you can really do.
The story is really expertly written, and I actually do think it would be good for middle school students because it's not a complicated theme,
no,
but it's explored in some fun ways. I'm pulled between materialism and altruism. That's basically what it is. And what does that mean?
Yeah.
Which we're going to get to. I think it'd be great for that age.
The following morning, Silas gets up and he decides that he's going to look for the legless man. He finds him drawing on the pavement with chalk. He's drawing sylvan scenes of marvelous beauty and delicacy, swaying trees and a leaping brook that seems alive.
And there's that word sylvan. You know, Silas is a derivation of that.
Silas asks the man who he is, and he doesn't answer. Then one of the drawings, he notices a satyr playing pipes, or maybe the god Pan. You know, he's got goat legs in this painting. But the face looks just like the face of the legless man. The legless man does something with his hand, or he goes, draws, makes a quick motion, and then the legs on the drawing are gone, leaving just the man there without legs. And then the legless man looks up at him and he says, they were evil.
He cut off his goat legs.
Yeah.
Did you see that coming? I didn't even think about it.
Yeah, I thought when he said they were evil, that gave me the impression that he had them removed.
But I didn't know he was Pan yet. Oh, it gave that he had his legs removed, but I didn't know they were goat legs. I don't know. The story was worth the price of admission for that revelation. That's really cool.
It's crazy. I don't really... Let's get to the end of it. I want to talk about it. There's a lot about
like
this stuff.
Like a surgically altered thing of legend is really cool.
It's way out there. I'm not quite sure what it means, but we're almost to the end here. The legless man isn't being creepy. He's full of joy, but in his joy, he is creepy, and that freaks Silas out, and he leaves. He feels like he's come to the realization that it is his wealth. It's his money that's tying him down. That's, you know, that this feeling that he's having, it's holding him to this world.
But was it? Was that really it? Was there a deeper and more pointed truth that he had not seen? Not wealth itself, but love of wealth was the chain.
He knew now clearly the two forces that were tearing at him. The warm composite strength of materialism that enclosed and surrounded him, and the opposite to it, the clear imperative call. He named it to himself the call of the wings. So sacrifice was being asked of him, the sacrifice of that which was most dear to him, that was part of himself. Part of himself? He remembered the man without legs saying.
Yeah, cutting off your goat legs is a huge sacrifice. One thing I probably wouldn't have anticipated that is because he said they were evil, and I can't imagine anybody. I mean, you have goat legs.
Yeah.
You can probably climb up on a mountain real easily if you wanted to. That's an asset.
Oh, yeah. We jump to the future a bit. We're at the East End Mission run by Dick Barrow. Dick is surprised to see Silas down there, but Silas has good news, and he wants to tell him in person. He's giving all of his money to the parish, all of it. And Dick is shocked and he asks, why? He goes, I can't explain. Remember our talk about visions last February? Well, a vision got a hold of me. And I thought this was interesting. It's splendid, Barrow leaned forward, his eyes gleaming. There's nothing particularly splendid about it, said Hammer grimly. I don't care a button about poverty in the East End. All they want is grit. I was poor enough and I got out of it. But I've got to get rid of money and these tomfool societies shan't get a hold of it. You're a man I can trust. Feed bodies or souls with it, preferably the former. I've been hungry, but you can do as you like. So he's giving away his whole fortune, but it's not an altruistic reason. He's doing it to get something. He wants this ascension. He doesn't seem to be bothered about helping people at all.
No, he hasn't made the connection.
So he tells Dick that he has nothing left but a twopence. So Silas leaves and decides he's going to take the tube to the park and just hang out there and be free, because now he has no money, so he has nothing to hold him down, and he could just be free, because that's what all the poor people, that's how they feel. They feel so free. So down in the tube station, he stands on the platform, and he could hear the train coming. A young drunk man gets up and is going to get ready to stand and wait for the train as it comes, but he just stumbles and falls right onto the track. 100 thoughts rushed simultaneously into Hammer's brain. He saw a huddled heap run over by a motor bus and heard the hoarse voice saying, "Don't blame yourself, governor. You couldn't have done nothing." With that came the knowledge that this life could be saved if it were saved by himself. Now, he's the only one here that can save this guy, and he might just get himself killed along with this dude, because he's got to jump down and then pull the guy up and do this as this train's coming right at him. He feels like he's standing there contemplating this for an eternity.
To the terrified spectators at the other end of the platform, there seemed no gap between the boy's fall and the man's jump after him. And then the train rushing round the curve of the tunnel, powerless to pull up in time. Swiftly, Hammer caught up the lad in his arms. No natural gallant impulse swayed him. His shivering flesh was but obeying the command of the alien spirit that called for sacrifice. With a last effort, he flung the lad forward onto the platform, falling himself. Then, suddenly, his fear died. The material world held him down no longer. He was free of his shackles. He fancied for a moment that he heard the joyous piping of Pan. Then, nearer and louder, swallowing up all else, came the glad rushing of innumerable wings, enveloping and encircling him.
And that's the end of the story. So, yeah, this is a deceptive one. I'm tempted to chalk it up a bit to Christian moralizing, except why bring Pan in?
Yeah, I guess he's a symbol of hedonism.
Yeah, I thought maybe that was it. His legs were evil, and they associate him more with the devil as well. I mean, the Pan characters became demons.
Right. Satyrs and Pan, aren't they all supposed to be very, you know, lascivious and sensualists, and they like the drink and the wine and the sex and all that stuff.
And they're of the earth, you know, they're forest spirits and nature spirits. And obviously a man with no legs, that's a clear metaphor for detachment from earthly desire. And if they're goat legs, which are of these creatures that are of the woods, of the earth, then it's a double metaphor, I guess. Arthur Machen, I mean, the story's 33, so his stuff was coming out mostly a couple decades before or a decade before, but he's famous for the great god Pan, but also for that story, The Bowmen. We've never covered it, but that's sort of his most famous story because that was the one about the angels helping out British troops during the war. It came out in 1914.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of those like War of the Worlds kind of accidental hoaxes because it got published and people thought it was a real thing that happened. And so now the Angel of Mons is still a thing.
Yeah, yeah. People I think remember, yeah.
Yeah, we talked about it. But, you know, I saw the ideas in The Bowmen in The Hound of Death a little bit. The idea that the nun killed all of these German mm-hmm. soldiers.
Yeah.
That God is conspiring and the angels are conspiring to help the British in that war. And then here we have Pan and the wing imagery again. So I think maybe Mrs. Christie was a bit of a Machen freak.
Could be. And I feel like The Hound of Death was way more out there. And it didn't feel like it had Christian overtones. In fact, I feel like it was subverting them almost with that stuff.
Yeah.
Because, she, you know, she had some whole other religion that was going on. Even though she was Christian, it was like, oh yeah, no, I'm actually part of this religion that's older than Christianity. That stuff was cool and trippy. This does feel like a little bit of Christian moralizing, like you're saying. What really sticks in my craw about it is that whole being poor sets you free or money holds you down. But
I don't think the story's saying that. I think that that's the backward idea, perhaps, that the main character has. He goes, I'm going to give up all my money to these people. I'm going to have that interaction. Like you called out, he's trying to get something out of it.
Yeah.
But what he needed to understand is that it's not about resources. It's about putting another person before yourself.
Yeah.
That was the thing he needed to do. Not the money in the end didn't matter. So he's confused because he only sees it in those terms.
Yeah.
And when he's backward in his thinking, he goes, look at all these people, they're free. And obviously they are not free, nor are most of them happy. It's just the guy he knows who's free. And that guy's free because he has a spirituality. He has a vision. He has a faith. And that's
yes.
So it shouldn't jive with you. I think she doesn't want it to. I think you're supposed to have that reaction. It's wrongheaded to think about it in those terms. You could be rich or poor or whatever, but do you have purpose and reason and vision? And that's why I said I'm tempted to chalk it up to Christian moralizing, but I wasn't sure because it seemed like it was expressing a bigger idea. This guy is not, maybe he's a parson, but it's a mission that's just feeding people. It's not necessarily, well, earlier I had said I think spirituality is important.
Yeah.
And that I also have a bleak view of the world. You know, I'm not a religious person and I feel like death is death and this is where I'll work that way.
Yep.
And I have a Lovecraftian worldview, which is that this is all random and crazy and ultimately meaningless. So how can you operate like that? And I think it's, you know, for me, it's creativity. I love the way the world falls together and conspires to create stuff. I mean, that is a faith for me. It's a way to go, I don't really know what I'm going to work on next or what this is, but the universe will just give it to me. And it always does, you know, a bit of something that you saw this show even, you know, it usually is made up of parts of what we've been watching lately and talking about and what's going on in the world. And we don't pick these things too far in advance. And sometimes something will just land in our lap and it's perfect. And all of those things make me feel more connected. And that's sort of what I get off on that spiritual level, that it feels like there's purpose because you're driving towards a product that you're going to create. It's going to come from all these random things and then be something and then be its own entity. And the process of that keeps me alive, you know? And I feel like people need to have something like that. For some people, it's faith. For some people, it's a more active physical life. But you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Just that profound connection with other people in the world and with the world itself. And so I don't know if she's necessarily saying, get right with Christ.
No, No, I think you're right. I think what you pointed out, the fact that he thought it was that character that thought it was about the money and not having money and that poor people are free. And that wasn't what it was about. The only time that he was able to ascend was when he realized it was about putting other people before himself.
Yeah. She's a good writer. And next up, we're going to be doing Dorothy L. Sayers, who is known for mystery work, but has a story. What was it?
The Leopard Lady?
The Leopard Lady. We're going to do that one by Dorothy Sayers. I want to thank Stuart Huntsman once again for the recommendation.
I want to thank the amazing Andrew Lieben for reading like a champion. And I want everybody to head on over to the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society and get yourself some awesome stuff. Pre-order Curse of Yig, because that stuff is going to be dope.
I also want to thank some patrons, Marion Bongiovanni.
I'd like to thank Brian Knight.
I'd like to thank Natu Cthulhu. Oh, you're just the right amount of Cthulhu.
Just the right amount. Thank you, Zach Erickson.
Thank you, Lisa LaPlaca.
I'd like to thank Daniel Wild.
Ronnie Marks, thanks so much.
I'd like to thank Victor H. Rodriguez.
Yeah.
My old gaming friend from Los Angeles who now lives up north in Seattle,
yeah,
I think.
Seattle area. Yeah. He's writing books, you know. Look him up, folks. Victor H. Rodriguez. He's a very good horror author.
He is. Right. Find his stuff.
I want to thank James DeBrucker.
And finally, I'd like to thank Jim Tierney.
And thank you all for listening. This week, we're going to be back with more Weird Tales by Mystery Authors. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. And you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast
at hppodcraft.com.